In the beginning, there was a duck. A scorp, actually, for those of you that know the difference. I certainly didn't. In fact, this is an account given in the Finnish folk epic, the Kalevala. Now, you'll find a lot of references to Finland in my talk. That's because I'm there spending a happy year on research leave, thanks to their invitation. So I learnt there that in the Kalevala, the world began like this. The duck laid six eggs on the knee of Ilmatar, who was floating in the sea. Ilmatar was the goddess, the daughter of the air. Ilmatar, disturbed by the heat of the duck nesting, caused an egg to roll off her knee, and one of the eggs broke. And the halves of the eggs split in two. One half became the earth and the other the heavens. The white was the moon and the yolk the sun. So this is a beautiful story about the beginning of the earth and the heavens. And I'm telling a story too. Although the story is quite different in content, I face the same challenges and necessarily will be very selective and occasionally misleading, but hopefully those of you who notice will realise that it's for a purpose. And the story is always told from a viewpoint, and my viewpoint is that I'm a theoretical physicist. And so I will very often emphasise occasions where the theorist has predicted and the observer has observed. So the science of the beginning begins, in my story anyway, with Einstein and his general theory of relativity, which he published in 1916 after a decade of very, very hard work. Now, general relativity is a theory of gravity, ultimately. It's also a theory of space and time. And in this theory, space and time are actually dynamical. They change and they respond. They're actually actors in physics rather than just some scenery on which physics happens. And the physical content of general relativity is very nicely summarised by a comment by a famous relativist, John Wheeler. Space-time tells matter how to move, and matter tells space-time how to curve. And this is illustrated with this picture, which is kind of like the rubber sheet model of general relativity. You can imagine masses causing the rubber sheet to bend, and particles, including particles of light, respond to this bending by curving. So, for example, if you're sitting on the Earth and you want to look at the star B, you'll find that it's displaced to place A because the light is curved, follows a curved path moving around the Sun, or an apparently curved path in this representation. So this was a prediction of general relativity, and it was observed in 1919 and reported widely around the world, in particular by the New York Times, which says that, I like this, men of science were more or less agog. So it was very natural for Einstein and others to try and apply general relativity not only to the motion of light around the Sun, but also to the whole universe. And the universe at the time could be summarised as the island universe. If you look up into a dark night sky, you'll see a band of cloudy stuff, which is made of millions, billions of stars. And it was understood that we lived in the middle of this band, which was arranged in a kind of disc, perhaps with a bulge in the middle. And here's a very nice artist's representation. So it was known that we were somewhere in this disc, otherwise it was known that nothing much changed in the heavens. And so Einstein found, from his equations, a solution which represented a static universe that had been around forever. But in order to do this, he had to add an extra piece to his beautiful theory, which is these days called the cosmological constant. So according to George Gamow, who we'll hear from later, Einstein described this as the biggest blunder of his life. But we'll learn that George Gamow might not have been the most reliable observer, and I'm not sure that Einstein ever used this phrase. So modern cosmology began with Friedman and Lemaître working independently, one in the newly Soviet Russia and the other in Belgium. They both independently came up from general relativity a theory of an expanding universe containing uniformly distributed matter. So in this cosmology, in this description of the universe, they find from general relativity that space itself expands in response to the presence of the matter. And you'll notice if you're sitting on one of these objects that distant objects recede with an apparent velocity proportional to distance. And this is true wherever you're sitting in the universe. There's no center of expansion. So this balloon, graphic of an inflating balloon, is supposed to illustrate that if you're sitting on any of those dots, which represent positions in the universe, you'll see that all the dots move away from you, and the further away the dot is, the further it moves. So what also happens is that the light emitted from the dots, from the galaxies, is stretched by the expansion, and the wavelength increases, and you notice the light getting redder as a result. So this is the famous cosmological redshift by which you infer the expansion of the universe. And on the right, I've used a little trick that I'm going to use again and again. I'm going to borrow one of the dimensions of space and use it to represent something else. So x and y represent positions in space, and t is time. So here, these little slices are supposed to represent slices in space at different points in time. And this is a graphic supposed to represent the expansion of the universe. So the reception to these brilliant ideas was not what you might imagine. In fact, Lemaître reported Einstein as saying, "Your calculations are correct, but your physics is abominable." Actually, the French was abominable. So you can imagine how Lemaître felt. But the confirmation of his ideas were not long in coming. And in order to track that development, we should go back to 1912 when Henrietta Leavitt discovered there was a relationship between the period and the luminosity for a kind of variable star called Cepheid variables. So these stars brighten and dim in a regular manner, and the time which it takes to go through a cycle of brightening and dimming depends on the absolute, the intrinsic brightness of the star. So you know that the slower this variability is, the intrinsically brighter the star is. And with that knowledge, you can tell how far it is. It's a bit like, it's called a standard candle, and the graphic illustrates what it means. If you know how intrinsically bright something is, like a candle, you can tell how far away it is just by what its apparent brightness is. So this was a breakthrough and led to quite a dramatic change in the view of the universe from this island universe that Einstein knew about in 1917. And in particular, attention was focused on nebulae, and nebulae with a spiral structure, which were cloudy patches that people could see through telescopes, and indeed, the Andromeda Nebula is one that you can see on a dark night with your naked eye. And the question is, what were they? Were they like, for example, the Orion Nebula, something local in our island universe, or galaxy as we now call it, or were they much further away? It was discovered in 1917 that their light was Doppler shifted. They were moving very fast. And the famous astronomer Edwin Hubble in 1924 used Leavitt's technique to find that they were far outside our own galaxy. And working hard on measuring distances, Determining the speeds of galaxies, Hubble and his talented assistant Hummerson in 1929 and 1931 made quite an outstanding discovery. And this is summarized on the graphs on the right. If you plot the distance of the galaxy as measured by the Cepheid technique, along with its recession velocity as measured by the Doppler shift of the light, you find there's a linear relationship. And the 1929 data perhaps might not convince you, but the 1931 data certainly should, and convince the rest of the world that there was indeed this linear velocity velocity-distance relationship between galaxies. And this is exactly as predicted by the Lemaître and Friedman cosmology and general relativity. So from this we conclude that indeed Friedman and Lemaître were correct. Space is expanding, and Einstein was very quick to accept that he had been too hasty in dismissing Lemaître's ideas. In fact, he'd committed the classic theorist's error of believing the data, and recommended him for a prestigious prize in 1934. Friedman, unfortunately, had died by then. He died very young of a disease which is now very preventable. So the universe of the 1930s had expanded dramatically in a figurative sense. Not just one galaxy, but millions of galaxies were known, each of those with hundreds of billions of stars at distances of tens of megaparsecs. I should have emphasized how big a parsec and a megaparsec is. A parsec is an astronomer's unit of measure, and it's about the distance that light travels in just over 3 years. That's a very long distance. And a megaparsec is a million of those, and it's about 10 to the 22, that's one followed by 22 zeros, meters. So the universe was realized to be extremely large, and the galaxies were also realized to be moving apart extremely fast, up to, at that time, the record was something like 20,000 kilometers per second. So this rushing apart of galaxies raises an interesting question. What happened earlier? Both Friedman and Lemaître recognized that their cosmology had a beginning. And this beginning, as you approach this beginning, looking back in time, the average distance between objects in the universe decreases and eventually tends to zero, at which point the density would go to infinity, if this indeed were the case. And this led Lemaître to one of the first speculations about the nature of the beginning of the universe, which he called the primeval atom, which was inspired by the new ideas of quantum mechanics around at the time. But my story of the beginning of the Big Bang really takes flight after World War II, after there had been a lot of development and understanding, for obvious reasons, of nuclear physics. So two people, Ralph Alpha and George Gamow. Alpha was Gamow's student, and Gamow we met earlier as reporting Einstein to have admitted a blunder. They realized that very early on in the universe, when material was very dense and closely packed together, it would also have been very hot. And you can kind of get a flavor for this effect when you pump up your bicycle tires. You're compressing the gas and the gas in the pump, and the pump heats up. And thanks to this heat, the enormous energy available must have broken down the material, whatever it was, to its elementary constituents. So what were the elementary constituents in 1948? Gamow and Alpha would have known about the periodic table of elements, more or less as we know it now, and they would have known that every atom of in this table of elements contained electrons orbiting around a small central nucleus, and inside this nucleus were protons and neutrons. And protons were positively charged, neutrons neutral. But there were also particles of light, photons, another development of the 20s and 30s. There were also neutrinos, particles which hadn't actually yet been directly detected, but were inferred to exist from the process of radioactivity. And they would also have been aware that most of the universe was made of just two of these elements, the lightest ones, hydrogen, which has just got one proton in its nucleus, and helium, which is two protons and two neutrons. So using just this information, they were able to come up with a theory of the origin of all the elements. So they said, well, the early universe was a gas of very hot elementary particles, so electrons, protons, neutrons, photons, and neutrinos. And just from that hypothesis and the equations of general relativity, they discovered that nuclear reactions within the first 3 minutes of the Friedmann-Lemaître cosmology made helium and, they said, heavier elements just out of protons and neutrons. And this this graphic gives you a sketch of how that might happen. A neutron finds a proton and makes an isotope of hydrogen deuterium, which consists of a bound state of neutron and proton. This is quite a delicate thing and is disrupted by any photons, that high-energy photons, gamma rays, that happen to be around at the time. As the universe expands, the gamma rays get more dilute, and eventually a deuterium nucleus can stick around long enough for a neutron to find it and make tritium, which then can subsequently absorb a proton and make the helium that we're looking for. So this is just one of the many reactions that alpha and gamma mapped out in the first 3 minutes of the universe. So this was work done in 1948, and Gamow could not help but notice that it was going to be published on April the 1st, 1948. And you'll notice that an extra name has crept on the list. Unknown either to Beta or Alpha, Gamow had added it in order that the paper should henceforth be known as the Alpha-Beta-Gamow paper. So it must have seemed immensely funny to Gamow at the time, but I think that the joke was unfortunately on Alpha, who got much less credit than he deserved for the work, because everybody immediately assumed that the mere PhD student had just been along for the ride. Not long afterwards, again in 1948, Alpha collaborated with, that's Alpha on the right again and Hermann on the left, collaborated with Hermann and made a prediction which could be tested. So they realized that all these photons that were around disrupting deuterium and so on would have remained around and would be visible today in the form of some kind of relic electromagnetic radiation. And the peak of the frequency spectrum of this radiation should be in the microwave. So that was the best place to go and look for them with a microwave detector. And they inferred a temperature of about 5 degrees above absolute zero, 5 Kelvin for this radiation. So radiation, to infer a temperature of radiation, one has to know that a hot body radiates a characteristic frequency spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. If, for example, like the surface of the sun, it's 5,000 Kelvin, then you find that the frequency spectrum peaks in the visible. In fact, that's why our eyes have evolved, of course, to detect this light. As you cool the object down, the light gets redder, eventually it goes into the wavelength gets longer, it goes into the infrared, and at about 5 Kelvin, the peak of this frequency spectrum is well over somewhere buried in the hill over there, corresponding to microwave radiation. Now, this wasn't the only idea around at the time. Over in Britain, another idea was being championed by Fred Hoyle, a very famous British astronomer, and he was advocating, along with his colleagues Gould and Bondi, a steady state, because he had a very strong philosophical objection, as do many still, of a beginning in time. So he thought that the universe was just expanding continuously, and that matter, instead of being made at the beginning of the universe, it was made continuously and filled up the space between the expanding galaxies. And as for the origin of the elements, well, they were made in stars, not in the initial moments of the universe. In fact, the name Big Bang comes from Hoyle. In a famous radio broadcast in 1949, kind of an early example of outreach, he said, these theories, describing the theories of Friedman, Lemaître, Alpha and Gamow, these theories were based on the hypothesis that all the matter in the universe was created in one big bang at a particular time in the remote past. Or big bang. So he was. Some people have thought he was being being rude about the Big Bang, but this doesn't seem particularly rude to me. It seems to me a very good example of trying to convey a picture of outreach, of public understanding. So this battle between Big Bang and steady state continued throughout the 1950s, but the crowning observation which convinced most people that the Big Bang was right was the observation of the relic radiation that Alpha and Hermann had predicted. And this was made by Penzias and Wilson in 1964, and you'll see the date 64 coming up again and again in this talk. So they were working at Bell Labs, a telecommunications company, and they were testing a new microwave receiver. And they wanted to eliminate all kinds of background noise so that they could detect fainter signals for communication purposes. But they discovered there was one source of noise that they couldn't get rid of, and that was microwaves coming from all directions. It wasn't associated with any particular object like the sun, they found that as well, but it was coming from all directions in the sky. With an intensity, it was realized subsequently by Princeton astronomers Dickey and Peebles, consistent with Alpha and Hermann's predictions. In fact, Dickey and Peebles didn't know about Alpha and Hermann's predictions. They had kind of been lost in the literature. But nonetheless, it was soon the gap was soon filled in, and it was understood that the prediction of a hot initial phase of the universe had been verified, and the Big Bang since then has been very widely accepted. So since then, as I said, the acceptance has been wide, and every piece of data that has come in has kind of fit in with that picture. And the universe today, as revealed by instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope and others, looks something like this in sketch map. So maybe if I can pause and take the lights down slightly, you'll be able to see this picture, because it's a very nice picture. The background is a picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope over many millions of seconds of exposure time, and it shows the very furthest reaches of the universe, which we now understand to be many billions, tens of billions of light years away. And as we look further away, we're also looking back in time, and we understand now that the origin of time, where it all began in the Big Bang model, is around 13 billion years ago. And the reason why the distance is bigger than 13 billion light years is because space has been expanding in the meantime. And so we can see hundreds of billions of galaxies, many thousands of megaparsecs away, with recession speeds nearly that of light. So their light is actually not visible anymore. It's one has to use infrared telescopes to detect it. And we are seeing objects, galaxies, new galaxies, which were being born a few hundred million years after the Big Bang itself. At the same time, we understand in quite a lot of detail, in quite a lot of quantitative detail, where the elements in the universe came from, and in particular, the light elements, deuterium, the isotope of hydrogen that we talked about before, helium-3, two protons and a neutron, and lithium. And the theory of the generation of these elements is called nucleosynthesis. And it's in good agreement with admittedly very difficult observations as to the abundance of the elements in the universe. One has to rely on light from very different, distant objects. And this is a slightly technical chart. It's supposed to give you a flavour of the... it's rather old now, so actually the agreement has kind of sharpened up in the meantime. But it gives you a flavour of the theory, which is these curves, and the observation, which are these rectangular patches and this bar here. So what's plotted on the x and y axis? So this is the present density of visible matter in the universe, which is very difficult to measure precisely. So that's why it's given as a kind of a band, and also the proportion of material in the universe which is taken up by helium, which is about 25%, helium-3, an isotope of helium, and deuterium, which is about one part in 100,000 of the stuff that you can see. And you can see that the observations line up with the theory very well, at least in this chart. Now, more recently, there's some discrepancy with the lithium observations, but people are willing to let that ride and look for explanations in the details of the way that stars burn fuel. But Hoyle was right about one thing, which is that the heavier elements, such as the ones that we're mostly made of, are indeed made in stars. And he was right about many other things too, just not about probably not about the steady state. So let's explore where we are in this sort of in our mental picture, both of the time involved, what times we're talking about, and also about what sizes we're talking about. So this is a graph plotting the radius of what we see now. So that sphere that I showed earlier, which was tens of billions of light years across, in terms of meters, it's getting on for it's more than 10 to the 27 meters across. In terms of time, we're now at 13 billion years, or 4 times 10 to the 17 seconds. Many seconds to measure off. So the universe is expanding, as I told you, so we can ask ourselves, how big was this patch that we can see now back in the past? And at the time that we're talking about nuclear time of when these light elements were made, we're talking about a time between about 1 second and 100 seconds, or 3 minutes near enough, when the temperature was about 10 to the 10, that's 10 billion Kelvin or Celsius, it doesn't really matter at that point. And the our observable universe would have been packed into a size of 10 to the 18 meters, or about 100 light years. So that's still quite a big object from the terrestrial point of view, but from the universe's point of view, it's tiny. It's really only a small patch of our galaxy. So this is the picture of the universe in the Big Bang model that we're more or less certain just from the consistency of all the observations to be the case. So now I'm going to change gear and talk about some more recent discoveries in the world of particle physics. So July the 4th, 2012, was a very significant date. It was my parents' 62nd wedding anniversary. Yeah. But other physicists find more significant the fact that there was a tremendous announcement made at CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research. And they announced the discovery of a new particle, which was described as Higgs boson-like. It had a mass of 125 GeV, so these are particle physicist units, and a GeV is about the mass of a proton. What's the mass of a proton? Well, it's about 10 to the minus 27 of a kilogram, so pretty small. But nonetheless, this Higgs boson-like particle has a mass of 125 of those. So what was the excitement all about? Why were people queuing overnight to get into the lecture theatre where the discovery was announced? Well, to answer that question, I have to pose another one, which is, how do particles get mass? So all elementary particles that we know about, except for two, I'll come back to that later, the photon and the gluon, have mass. So the question for a particle theorist is, how do I account for that mass? What theories can account for the presence of this mass in a particle. And more specifically, the question of the early 1960s was, how do the particles which convey the weak force get mass? So I'm going to explain a little bit more about the context of modern particle physics, and hopefully explain a little bit more about the weak force itself. So let's go back to a more modern understanding, a slightly anachronistic one from the point of view of the early 60s, of what's going on inside the atom. So we remember that back in 1948, we had electrons orbiting outside a nucleus consisting of protons and neutrons. And what I didn't do at the time was give you a sense of what the scale was, the scale difference between the protons and the size of the atom was. And this graphic illustrates it not very well with the picture, but the text does. So if the proton and the neutron, the particles making up the nucleus, are about this big, about the size of a tennis ball, then the electrons are whizzing about somewhere between Lewis and the peer. So the difference in scale between an atom and a proton is really quite large. So the things that keep the electrons around the nucleus, well, it's the electromagnetic force, and a particle physicist understands that forces are conveyed by the exchange of particles, and the particle that conveys the electromagnetic force is the photon. And inside the protons and neutrons, there are actually further particles, which we understand now. In fact, in 1964, it was postulated that inside the protons and neutrons, there were further particles called up and down quarks, and that subsequently turned out to be the case. So these particles and the protons and neutrons themselves are bound together by a different force called the strong force, because it's strong, and these forces conveyed by gluons. Finally, there's another force, which is slightly different in character from the other two, the weak force, because what it does, it changes a particle identity. So, for example, the weak force causes the neutron to change into a proton with the emission of an electron and a neutrino. And the weak force is thought to be conveyed, and now understood very well to be conveyed, by a particle which is now called the W. So it changes the particle identity. So within the neutron changes to a proton, or within the neutron, a down quark changes to an up quark. So the weak force is responsible, as I said, for radioactivity. It's also very important in regulating the nuclear reactions that cause the sun to shine. And both of these processes, radioactive decay and sunshine, involve the weak force, and a characteristic byproduct of the weak force is the emission of a neutrino. So we understand now that everything is made of electrons, up quarks, down quarks, neutrinos, photons, and gluons, and with the W particle mediating radioactive decays like this. But actually, if you bang particles together at higher and higher energy, you find a whole lot more. In fact, this structure of up, down, neutrino, and electron is replicated three times, which seems remarkably profligate. And there is another particle involved in the weak force, which is the called the Z. So this is our pre-2012, this was our inventory of elementary particles. Some features of these particles. Well, these extra particles are very unstable, and they decay in your particle detector. Here's a graphic for the interior of ATLAS, one of the detectors at LHC, showing what happens. The unstable particles produce the stable ones in a big shower, which we see, whose traces we see in the detector. As I said before, most of these particles, apart from the photon and the gluon, have mass. So then we come back to the question again, how do these particles get mass? And in particular, how do the Z and W bosons get mass, which make this mass is partly responsible for why the weak force is so different in character from the electromagnetic and strong forces. Well, this was the question that this group of people independently, in three groups, were working on in 1964. Engler and Braut in Belgium, Peter Higgs, who I'm sure you've heard of, in Edinburgh, and the trio Guralnik, Hagen, and Tom Kibble, who you'll hear from later, is in Imperial College. So this was, again, something that happened in 1964. So that's three things that I've already mentioned, quarks and the discovery of the microwave background radiation. So what's the theory here? So the to give it its full name, the Braut, Engler, Higgs, Guralnik, Hagen, Kibble mechanism goes something like this. So the universe, they said, is filled with a scalar field. So what's a scalar field? A scalar field is really about the most simple thing that you can imagine. It's deceptively simple. Really, it's just a number in everywhere in space. That's what a field is. It's some kind of number everywhere in space. So they postulated that there was this scalar field. And I've represented it here again by my little trick of borrowing one of the dimensions of space to represent how something has a value everywhere in space. So here are two directions of space. You can imagine it to be the tabletop and the field, which is now known as the Higgs field, has some value. And what do we measure that value in? Well, we measure it in mass units because particles, in particular force-carrying particles, can get their mass from this field. So the particle physics mass units are GeV, and in modern parlance, we say that the Higgs field has a particular value, and it's 174 GeV. So there's a field, it's a scalar field, it means it's just a number. That number is, when measured in GeV, is 174, and the force-carrying particles get a mass from it. And indeed, the masses of all the particles are proportional to this number 174. And in 1967, it was understood how in detail the W and the Z particles got their mass. The model, this BEHGHK model, applied to a very simplified model of the weak interactions, and it really was the work of Tom Kibble again, and Weinberg and Salam, which sorted out how the W and the Z, the real W and Z particles, got their mass. So let's do a little bit of quantum field theory. Well, a field can support disturbances, a little bit like the surface of a pond. Again, I've used my little trick of representing, borrowing one of the dimensions in space to represent the value of a field changing. So if you disturb the field, the Higgs field, it reacts with wave-like motion. But if this this wave-like motion has a particle character as well, this is the quantum bit in quantum field theory, and so energy in this field is emitted and absorbed in lumps. So really the description particle and wave is a description of, you know, our everyday world, and quantum field theory is quantum field theory, and it makes the predictions, and the names particles and waves are our kind of pictures which help us understand. So Higgs particularly emphasized in his paper of 1964 that the scalar field that he was talking about should manifest itself as a particle. Now, I think all the people who wrote papers in 1964, all six people, understood that a scalar field meant a particle, but the theoretically interesting point at that time was the details of how the force-carrying particles got mass. But as I said, Higgs emphasized this fact and said that this was a particle, a massive particle, although at the time that mass could not be predicted. And the excitement was because of 2012 was because finding this particle validates this whole mechanism, this whole theory, and completes the theoretical structure that had been evolving with it in the 1960s and 70s, which is now called the standard model of particle physics. You can get your own T-shirt from, if you go to CERN, perhaps they do mail order, and here it is, that's the standard model, you can have that on your chest. So it's very easy to write down, but the difficult bit comes in working stuff out, starting from there. So the standard model is a remarkably successful theory, and it has 19 parameters, which are pretty well determined, but it really accounts for many more observations that one can make. And this graphic here is supposed to represent how good the standard model is. These are lots of different particle physics quantities that you can measure in an accelerator like LHC. And these horizontal bars are supposed to represent the difference between the standard model prediction and what's actually observed. And it's done in these units of what are called sigma. So the larger the bar, the more unlikely this observation is to have happened by chance, which is bad for the theory. And anything below 3 in these units is considered okay. And you can see that, and 5, you might have heard about the 5 sigma discovery of the Higgs, counts as a discovery. So you can see there are a couple which are quite large, 2.5 away from the prediction, and a smart theorist might be investigating that, but there's nothing there that would make you not believe in the standard model. Standard model in its original formulation did not account for what we now know about neutrino properties, but a small extension with an extra 8 parameters, which are not yet well measured, and a very active area of research, both here at Sussex and elsewhere, can account for these neutrino properties. So the standard model is slightly weird. Why all those parameters, 27 of them if you include the neutrinos, why is this 3 families? And then turning to cosmology, how does it account for the fact that there's actually more antimatter than matter, there's more matter than antimatter in the universe. So 5% of the stuff in the universe we can see in the form of ordinary matter, mostly hydrogen and helium. We see essentially no antimatter unless we make it ourselves. We also know that there's 25% of the stuff in the form of something that we don't, a particle whose identity we don't know, called dark matter. And we also know that the universe is accelerating, more about that later, thanks to some mysterious dark energy. But let's carry on thinking about the standard model and cosmology. And so let's think about, as Alpha and Gamow did, let's think about heating it up. So in order to think about a hot universe, we should think about its energy density. And this is actually important for discovering, for fitting this into the context of the Friedmann-Lemaître cosmology and Einstein's equations. So the particles in our hot, dense gas of elementary particles, well, they have energy in the form of mass energy. So their masses have energy. But remember, their masses depend on the value of this Higgs field. They also have kinetic energy, because as you compress them, they bomb around faster and faster, and that is the sort of representation of temperature. But the Higgs field itself actually has another kind of energy. It has potential energy density. That was that funny V on the T-shirt you saw. And the potential energy you can represent like this, with this curve here. The Higgs field likes to sit at the minimum of its potential energy density, which is here at 174 GeV, as I said before, but it has a maximum up here at 0. So ordinarily, that's a huge energy difference, and that's why the Higgs field sits here and not up there. But as you increase the density of the particles, eventually you can reduce the energy by sending the Higgs field to zero, because all the particles become massless, you save all that mass energy, and that's enough to result in a net reduction of energy. So at that point, sufficiently early on in the history of the universe, particles will become massless. And this was realized by the Russian theorist Kuznets in 1972, actually, and not while the Standard Model was finishing being formulated. And this is what we call, in modern parlance, a phase transition. So what are we talking about? What time are we talking about now? So this would have happened. So here we are at, we were talking before about 1 second after the Big Bang. But in order to make everything massless, we have to compress everything so that the temperature is not 10 to the 10, but 10 to the 15 Kelvin. So that's 100,000 times higher, at which point the universe was only 10 to the minus 11, a hundredth of a nanosecond old. And so this is the time that we're now talking about. And the universe was smaller, the entire observable universe was fit into a ball which is smaller than our solar system. So phase transitions, what are they? Well, you see them all the time, every time you boil the kettle. Water has phase transitions. So when you boil the kettle, you turn liquids to vapor, that's a phase transition, and it's accompanied by the formation of bubbles of vapor inside the liquid, and it can be quite a violent process. You can also see condensation happening when vapor turns to liquid through rapid cooling. One place you can see it is behind a high-altitude aircraft. The hot water from the combustion of the aviation fuel, the hot water vapor, turns into small droplets of water as they hit the cold air. So these are two different processes that can happen in water, vaporization and condensation. But actually, it turns out that if you go to high enough pressure, there is no difference between gas and liquid. Water becomes what's called a supercritical fluid. And if you look at, so this is a rather dull picture, it's just a view into a pressure cell of water at this above its critical point when it's doing this supercritical thing. And it's really a little bit dull, because all that happens as you reduce the temperature is that it goes from being a less dense supercritical fluid to being a more dense critical fluid. So, okay, so with this map of understanding of phase transitions, how does the Standard Model phase transition fit in? So instead of talking about liquid, we talk about the Higgs phase at low temperatures where the particles are massive, and at high temperatures where the particles are massless, and in particular the force-carrying particles, the Z and the W, become like the photons, we call that, it's a bit like the vapor phase, because of this symmetry between Z, W, and photon, we call that the symmetric phase. So at the time, it's only recently that we've discovered that the Higgs field was 125 GeV in mass. And before then, people explored the Standard Model phase transition for a variety of Higgs masses. And it was realized that if the Higgs had a mass of more than about 75 GeV, then the Standard Model behaves like a supercritical fluid. If it's less, then you could have this this condensation droplets forming in the early universe. And this theory was worked out by my hosts in Finland, so that's why I put a nice Finnish flag there. And so now that we know the mass of the Higgs is 125 GeV, we know that the Standard Model was a supercritical fluid, and so that sounds, and as I said before, nothing particularly interesting happens in the Standard Model at 10 to the minus 11 seconds. Perhaps a bit disappointing, but many physicists believe that the Standard Model is not the end of the story. There are many ideas about what's waiting to be discovered at the LHC, such as supersymmetry. This is the idea that every force-carrying particle is paired with a matter particle, and it has other features which it predicts explains what this dark matter is made of. and it predicts many more particles to be discovered. There may be more forces to be discovered, so more force-carrying particles. There may be more dimensions than the three of space and one of time that we know about. And indeed, particles may not be elementary after all. They may actually be made of tiny pieces of vibrating string. So the LHC is now off. It's for its upgrade. It's coming back in 2015 with twice the energy. And at the same time, people are looking harder at neutrinos and looking for dark matter. So there is plenty of scope for believing that within a few years, we will know if and what there is beyond the Standard Model. So in many of these new theories, the Higgs phase does condense in little droplets. And if it did, actually, condensation in the early universe is quite a violent process. And here is a little animation made by my colleague in Helsinki of the Higgs field condensing in bubbles and growing and merging to become the Higgs field that we know today. And this colour blue represents the value of 174 GeV. And these little ripples are, in fact, as I explained before, ripples in the Higgs field means that we can interpret them as Higgs particles. So that was then 10 to the minus 11 seconds. What about now? So I put this slide on just actually, it's new. This is stuff that we're actually doing right now, so I thought I'd put it up to entertain you and also to make sure my colleagues were aware of what I've been doing. I haven't just been larking about in the snow or skiing on frozen lakes or solving the knotty research problem of how to keep your beer cold in the sauna. That one's cracked, I'm happy to say, so we can go back to gravitational waves, which are the way by which we may see or get evidence for this condensation process happening in the very early universe. So what are gravitational waves? They're ripples in space-time predicted by Einstein, and what happens when one of these ripples goes through you is that you get stretched in one direction and compressed in another. So this is a very nice picture of what one might do to you. Of course, this is a vast exaggeration of what actually happens that I'll come back to. The way that gravitational waves are generated is by accelerating mass or accelerating energy. We know that they're equivalent. So for examples in today's universe are orbiting binary neutron stars or black holes or supernovae, but also violent events in the early universe like this Higgs phase condensation could also produce them. And they can be detected. And experiments right now, such as this one here in the United States, it's called LIGO, can potentially detect gravitational waves, certainly from the astronomical objects that I've mentioned. And in order to do that, one has to compare distances or lengths in two directions very accurately. And this one can compare a length over a few kilometres to one part in 10 to the 22. That's extraordinary position. So this one is running. Planned in space is one on a much bigger scale with arm lengths instead of a few kilometres, a few million kilometres. So this is planned but not approved for launch in 2020. And further in the future, there is another one, a Japanese project called DESIGO, which could has the sensitivity to detect gravitational waves from a condensing Higgs phase. Even further in the future, it may be that one can use atom beams to measure length instead of the laser beams that are used in these experiments. And my colleagues in the Atomic Molecular and Optical Physics group here at Sussex can tell you just how precisely one can measure things using the wave nature of atoms. So people are very fond of this idea of a condensing Higgs phase, partly because it might bring about an answer to the antimatter problem. It turns out that under the right circumstances, the advancing bubble walls can leave behind a small excess of matter over antimatter. The antimatter would have been annihilated by the matter, leaving a small excess which went on to become us, thanks to Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Now, any theory that that predicts this must arrange for the excess to be just right. It has to be about one part in 10 to the 10 in order to be consistent with what we observe in today's universe. So further beyond the standard model, there are more ideas waiting to be tested, even more difficult to test, such as grand unification, the idea that the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces are all part of the same kind of force. So this predicts new force-carrying particles and new phase transitions to give them mass and make them unobservable today. So, for example, grand unification predicts that there would have been a phase transition at a temperature 10 to the 13 times bigger than the standard model phase transition. At this phase transition, new exotic objects, topological defects, such as represented on the right, cosmic strings, which incidentally were also predicted many years ago by a name that should be becoming familiar to you now, again, Tom Kibble. So this is a simulation that I did on my laptop. We're doing simulations on essentially 32,000 laptops of this kind of thing now. So the idea is to try and predict how one might observe these the relics of those objects, cosmic strings, in today's universe. Going even further back in time, the scalar field, a scalar field, may come into play again. So the idea is that supposing a scalar field gets stuck on a potential hill, and then the potential energy density that this scalar field is responsible for is a constant. It doesn't matter how the universe expands, it's just a constant. And this leads to exponentially fast expansion, which we call inflation. And there's very strong evidence that this happened at around 10 to the minus 36 of a second in the history of the universe. And the evidence comes again from microwaves. The microwaves can trace the characteristic small pattern of density ripples that the theory of inflation predicts. And this pattern was first observed in 1992 with a microwave satellite called COBE, and in exquisite detail in 2003. By another one called WMAP, which convinced people that in inflation was correct. So let me give you another date now, April the 2nd, 2013, and this, perhaps for cosmologists, will be as exciting as 2012, July the 4th, was for particle physicists, because it's the results symposium of another microwave background satellite called Planck, which my colleagues in the Astronomy Centre here in Sussex are working on. And this has sufficient sensitivity and resolution to perhaps give us some information about what the identity of that scalar field that caused inflation was. And in particular, it could shed some light on the very interesting hypothesis that it's actually the standard model Higgs that's doing the work. And okay, well, cosmologists can never stop asking the question, well, what happened before that? So what happened before inflation at 10 to the minus 36 of a second? There are many ideas. Perhaps inflation is actually it's still going on elsewhere in the universe, bringing us back to the steady state picture. Our observable universe in this picture would be just a small patch which had condensed out of a larger inflating universe. And perhaps there are other patches, and perhaps they have different standard models, as string theorists have proposed. So there are many ideas, as I said, but the difficult thing is how to get data to test them. So, finally, what about that yoctosecond? What is a yoctosecond? Well, it's the smallest named unit of time. It's 10 to the minus 24 of a second. As Vice-Chancellor said, it's the time takes gluons change into quarks. It's the time of the strong interactions. But the significance in cosmology, well, I have to come clean here. I named the talk before I thought about what I was going to say. So I had to scrabble around desperately for what the significance of a yoctosecond was in cosmology. And in many ways, it's rather large. We've been talking about 10 to the minus 36 of a second. So I could say, well, it's 10 to the 12 inflation times. But actually, there is something significant. It's the time in a supersymmetric cosmology at which gravitinos are being made. And when the universe was hot enough to make gravitinos, which are the partners of the force-carrying graviton particle. And it turns out that if you make too many gravitinos, if your universe gets hotter than the temperature in the first yoctosecond, that messes up the Big Bang as we know it. So you don't really want the universe to be any hotter than it was at a yoctosecond. So it's the earliest time at which the standard hot Big Bang applies. If we discover supersymmetry at LHC, we'll know that we have to supplement the standard Big Bang by some more physics before the first yoctosecond. So to summarise, we know what happened very precisely from about 1 second on in the history of the universe, and I've given you a flavour of the observational evidence for that. With LHC and other experiments, we'll be able to better predict what happened much earlier in the history of the universe, 10 to the minus 11 seconds. Planck data coming out soon will test theories at 10 to the minus 36 of a second in the Big Bang. And this corresponds to huge energy. What's going to happen in the future? Well, it's easy to make predictions, but certainly completing the task of mapping the visible universe, visible meaning at all kinds of electromagnetic wavelengths, to better characterise what the nature of this scalar field is. Gravitational wave astronomy will become a new astronomy of this century, I think, and it'll help us observe violent processes that happened very, very early on in the history of the universe. And of course, particle physics will continue to find, we hope, new particles. We'll learn what the dark matter is, and we'll learn the properties of neutrinos are. And I think with this information, we'll learn the history of the universe not from 1 second, but we can hope to establish what the history of the universe was from about 10 to the minus 36 of a second. So finally, some thanks. Colleagues past and present, particularly at Sussex, which is a really stimulating department to work at. The person who set me out on the journey, some of which I've presented you today, who you're going to hear from next. Okay, thank you very much.